You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Sam Lowe about his book, Hawaiki Rising, Hokulea, Nainoa Thompson, and the Hawaiian Renaissance. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So as we're talking, around the time the canoe was built, parts of the Hawaiian culture were in danger of being lost. Some of the Hawaiian people you interviewed and sailed with described a disconnect to the Hawaiian culture. One person described it as, quote, growing up, I felt my Hawaiian culture ebbing away. So why were Hawaiians becoming disconnected with their traditions and culture?
It was 200 years of oppression. When the first missionaries arrived, the idea that their gods were no longer powerful, what we talked about earlier, that decimation of the population through disease. And it was a little bit more subtle than that. In school, the language was actually forbidden by law in 1926. The generations growing up in Hawaii could see that the culture was being taken over by haole planters, and they could see that their language was actually no longer useful to them. So my grandfather, my Hawaiian grandfather, who spoke Hawaiian fluently, did not teach his son. My father. And it created a kind of lost generation of people that had no knowledge that there was a culture that they were losing. So when I first went to Hawaii in 1964, what I encountered was a kind of island style of life, surfing, canoe paddling, hanging out. And that's what had happened to most Hawaiians. They knew that they couldn't get jobs very easily. They knew that they were looked down upon. They knew that they were in some ways discriminated against in their own island, and they began to incorporate that sense of failure into their own lives. And so it became sort of a culture, an underclass, a culture of failure, and there was this feeling that their culture was ebbing away, but it wasn't even conscious.
Right.
It was just a feeling of lack of pride, of lack of being a human being, of being in control of their own destiny.
Right. So Herb Connie's idea of bringing this back was a good one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about the specifics of the canoe. And we know that it was based on, you know, photographs or drawings, I should say, from these books. So tell us about the canoe itself.
The canoe is one of the most beautiful vessels that any sailor would ever perceive. She's 62 feet long. They're twin hulls that are symmetrical. They're absolutely the same. She's basically a catamaran. We think of catamarans as a very modern evolution of sailing yachts, but it was an evolution that took thousands of years in the Pacific. She's spanned by a deck. The hulls are separated by 21 feet. The deck is 17 feet wide. You sleep in the hulls. There are six bunks on either side, tiny little compartments. Mm-hmm. She's open to the elements on deck, and she has two crab claw sails, which are kind of the opposite of our Marconi rig. It's as if you lifted the thick part up to the sky. And she is one of the most beautiful vessels to ride. I came back from Tahiti to Hawaii on a Swan, which was a very beautiful racing yacht, high-tech racing yacht. As an escort vessel for one of the canoes, and that was awful. Mm. You know, you bang into the waves, you're leaning over. But when you're on Hokulea, it's like floating. She's just so sea kindly. She's gorgeous.
Yeah. All right. So one of the things that became very important was that the Hawaiian people embraced this project. And so they build the canoe and they sail to each of the Hawaiian islands to see what the reaction would be.
Right. That was Herb Connie's idea. Mm-hmm. Ben Finney wanted to sail the canoe as a scientific experiment. Herb Connie wanted to be sure that the Hawaiians accepted this canoe as their canoe.
Right.
And so they went from one island to the other. They trained crews on each island. People got to come aboard, got to sail on the canoe. They pulled into different ports on the islands. People came down and crowded around. The hills were thronging with people. And that's how I get a little emotional about it, but that's how Herb knew that this vessel was accepted by Hawaiians. And just as another point, When I wrote this book, I followed a similar pattern. The book was released in May in Hawaii, and I still don't have distribution on the mainland, but I wanted to distribute it widely in Hawaii to see what the reaction were, just like the canoe. Mm-hmm. Did Hawaiian people accept this book? If they did, then we'd sell it on the mainland. And they have.
And they have.
And we are.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things here, too, is sort of this pride turning to possessiveness.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, okay, you can imagine what it would be like growing up in a Hawaiian society as a Hawaiian. You knew how to surf. You knew how to paddle a canoe. You knew a few Hawaiian words, but you also knew that you were part of an underclass. You were part of a group of people that were expected to fail. And all of a sudden, you see this canoe, and you perceive that your people were among the world's greatest seafarers. And so pride starts to seep into your being, starts to become part of your life. Well, then you look back, and you say, wait a minute, how did it happen that I came from this, I have this ancestry of great seafarers, and I'm beginning to feel this pride, yet my parents were oppressed, and I was oppressed. What happened? So they began to look back, and they began to see the history of this oppression. They became very, very angry.
Mm-hmm.
And with the anger came this possessiveness. So even though the canoe was conceived by a Haole guy, Ben Finney, another half Haole guy, Tommy Holmes, and a Hawaiian, they began to think this canoe belongs to us Hawaiians and us Hawaiians alone. And there was this, out of this pain of rediscovery of what had happened to them, out of this anger came the sense of possessiveness. And it created a situation for a couple of years. It was a very dicey situation to be white and to be on that canoe.
Yeah. So let's talk about the crew. We have a crew that's going to sail this to Tahiti, and then there's another crew that's going to bring it back. So let's talk about that first crew. Some people had their doubts about that. I'm thinking Wally in particular was thinking, he could, because Wally was the peacekeeper, we should say, right? So tell us about Wally.
Well, Wally Froiseth was a famous Hawaiian surfer. He was a Californian. He was full-on Haole. Mm-hmm. But he lived among Hawaiians. He knew Hawaiians. He loved Hawaiians, and they loved him. So even though he was Haole, he kind of bridged that gap between the watermen, the Hawaiians who he spent all that time with in the surf, and who are going to be on the canoe, actually, as the first crew, and the Haole guys, Ben Finney and the other guys that were actually going to be the captains and the in charge of the canoe. He understood the pain that Hawaiians were going through, and he understood the anger. And he was afraid on that first voyage that when they went down to Tahiti that there might be friction between the Ben Finney and other folks that were going to be in charge of the canoe and the crew. And that's what happened. And when he saw the crew that was selected, he felt that there were a couple of people in that crew that were not competent to make a long voyage, and he stepped aside.
And he was right.
He was right. There was a certain amount of conflict that was carried aboard the canoe. Mau Pialik said, "We're going to sail on the ocean now. You will aloha each other. You will take care of each other. And any cares that you have, you leave behind." Well, that was difficult. This is a 30-day voyage. This is out of sight of land. Mm. And this crew, who were great surfers, who were great watermen, had never been out of sight of land before. So you can imagine that it got a little difficult.
The tension
built. On the other hand, there was one professional mariner on board, Dave Lyman, who had spent a lifetime at sea. And he said later of the kind of dissension that grew up on the canoe that he'd seen that all the time, that it was common. It was not, it was what normally happens among a crew on a long voyage in tight quarters. Mm-hmm. So a lot has been made of this kind of pilikia, this kind of tension that and conflict. But really, It's not so difficult to understand.
At one point, and I can't remember if this is when they first started out, or if it was before the trip to Haiti, the boat gets swamped.
Oh.
And so they had to make some adjustments.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So they, that's a scary thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've had some issues with the boat, and they're...
You had to go through an evolution with this boat. I mean, here's a canoe that no one has seen for centuries, right, much less sailed. And it was common for the sea to sort of splash aboard the canoe and get into the hulls. And the canoe had to be bailed all the time. Wally Froiseth knew that. When he was on board, he made sure everybody bailed it at the change of every watch every 4 hours. Well, another captain was in charge on a particular day. They forgot to bail. The canoe filled up and
boom,
and she swamped. Later improvements to the canoe dealt with that, but it is a problem with an open vessel.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so now adding to these tensions was the fact that there was a film crew from National Geographic that made this trip.
The voyage you're talking about in 1976, first voyage.
The first one to Tahiti. Yeah.
They did make a wonderful movie about it, by the way, but I've been a film producer, and you're a journalist, and so it's kind of natural to focus on dissension,
the drama
of it all. And it didn't help that there was a producer who focused on that, and that they put a cameraman, very good cameraman, very professional crew. But here is this simmering kind of difficulty between Hollies and Hawaiians, and here's this glass eye on you all the time. So it just magnified everything.
But they also had a what was the boat that there was a boat that kind of went along? The
yeah,
trip.
There was an escort boat.
The
escort boat. There were some mistakes made there too. They were not supposed to be in touch with the canoe, and they kept sending little messages over to the crew on board about where they were and about what was going back.
And so Mao, we talked about Mao a little bit earlier.
Mao Pialik,
the navigator, who is just amazing. His abilities were so amazing. He makes this trip, but he doesn't like what's happened on board. And he says, that's it. I'm not making a return trip.
It was unfortunate. It's understandable, but the producer of the National Geographic film was elated when the canoe actually arrived safely in Tahiti, and he made a mistake. He sent aboard 12 bottles of champagne. So naturally, the celebration turned to a little bit of drunkenness, turned to a brawl. Not a brawl, I shouldn't say that. It was a minor fisticuffs,
yes,
actually.
Yeah.
But Mao had always come from a tradition in which the navigator is in charge and the crew serves him, and they take care of each other and they take care of their canoe. And any kind of conflict like that on a canoe is impossible.
Yeah.
And so he left. Unacceptable. Yeah. He left.
And he was angry. And
he said, I'll never come back.
Yeah, don't look for me.
Right.
I'm not coming back. All right. So let's, before we get to the return trip, talk about the reaction as this pulls up in Tahiti.
Oh, my God. It was a national holiday in Tahiti. There were 40 or 50,000 people. Half the population of the island was thronging the shore. Tahitians had kept a lot of their culture. They kept their language, they kept their dances, their hula, they kept their chants, but they didn't have a canoe. Mm. And they didn't really have that appreciation of the greatness of their ancestors. And when they saw that canoe, they were astonished. Mm. They had to touch it. They had to get on board. And so half of the island tried to climb on board Hokulea, and unfortunately she almost sank.
So they had to do a few repairs before they and there it was celebrations.
There were songs that were composed. I think there were 6 or 7 songs that were composed to honor Hokulea. It was a major holiday, and it began this process of actually binding together islands. Hawaii and Tahiti were separate. Tahitian is French, Hawaiian is American. But this canoe started to stitch together the different cultures that had been colonized under different countries. Mm. And that was the beginning of a sense among the Tahitians and Hawaiians that we're brothers and sisters.
Right. So this science experiment that Ben wanted to do, they did it. They made it from Hawaii to Tahiti without modern instruments.
Right.
And so now they've got to make the return trip, but they don't have Mao who could read the stars.
Right.
So tell us about the crew going back.
Well, what they had to do is just get the canoe back to Hawaii. And so they bought Western navigators on board. The return crew, this was the first time that Nainoa Thompson, who is kind of the other major protagonist of my story, got to sail on the canoe. And he hoped that he would learn navigation with Mao Pialik, but Mao was gone.
Right.
So he determined that he would train himself. He would look at the stars. He knew about something called the star compass, that you could steer a canoe just as well, even better, by the rising and setting of stars. And he'd studied that a bit with Mao. So he steered by the compass. He tried to detect the subtle motion in the waves. He tried to keep track of the wind. He tried to understand how the canoe steered. He tried to keep her on course. And he trained himself as best he could on this voyage. And there were another young man with him named Snake Ahi, he was a famous surfer as well, who became one of Nainoa's best friends and who sailed on every other voyage. So it was the beginning of Nainoa's indoctrination, self-indoctrination, self-study into this world that he wanted to become more a part of.
And the second crew, the crew returning to Hawaii, we didn't see the problems that we saw with them. There wasn't the tensions. And I mean, this was a crew that really bonded well.
Right. You know, I think they had a chance to, they heard about the Pilikia. I think that they had a chance to perhaps select the crew a little bit better. I don't think there was that tension of, are they going to find land? You have to remember that when that first crew set out, they call themselves the guinea pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that crew is now involved in Hokulea. They're back in strong. They were setting out into the unknown. No one had voyaged on a vessel like this between Hawaii and Tahiti in 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And a lot of pressure. And particularly if you're not, haven't been at sea and out of sight of land. So there was fear involved. And now the canoe had made the voyage. They knew they could get safely back to Hawaii. Everything was a lot more relaxed.
Yeah. We're talking to Sam Lowe. His book is Hawaii Key Rising. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk a little bit more about Nainoa Thompson after a break.